Good evening and welcome to Behind the News for August 22, 2002. This is Doug Henwood and we're looking, as we do most weeks at this time, at the worlds of economics and politics. I've got one segment scheduled for tonight. I'll speak with the editors of a volume called After the World Trade Center, Sharon Zukin and Michael Sorkin. That's a look at how the World Trade Center came to be and what might come in its place. Before we get to that, several items. Every week when I get in here, my box is full of faxes from the Republican staff of the House Ways and Means Committee with their policy advice, most of which is pretty loopy and goes straight into the trash. This one was so particularly repellent, I thought I'd share it with you. What they're concerned about is a Senate version of the bill to reauthorize TANF, the Temporary Assistance for Needy Families, the stingy program that replaced AFDC, welfare reform, 5 years ago. It has to be reauthorized later this year, and there are two versions, one in the House and one in the Senate. The Senate one is somewhat softer than the House one, and the House Republicans just don't like several provisions of the Senate bill, and here are some of what they don't like.
Creates a new program allowing college to count for work credits. It fails to increase the hours of work from 30 to 40, even though a lot of single mothers are having a hard time finding daycare to cover 30, they want 40. Increases from 6 to 8 weeks the amount of job search, which can be accounted towards the work requirement. It exempts individuals from receiving at-home infant care program benefits from work. So newborns, mothers of newborns, they should really get out there and flip some burgers. It considers the bill, the Senate bill considers seasonal variations in food stamp caseloads in providing federal contingency funds to the states. It lowers the unemployment rate trigger for easy access to contingency funds. It creates small grants, $220 million, $250 million grants for abstinence programs and for welfare staff training and welfare benefit outreach. It creates additional benefits for Indian tribes, very small, $25 million, but that's a bit too much for the House. It reduces the funds available for marriage promotion below the level in the House bill. And this is all the things they're complaining about. What, boy, no, they should try to do it themselves, shouldn't they? And interview last week with former World Bank chief economist Joseph Stiglitz last Thursday attracted a lot of attention, though more abroad than at home. The big hook was the evolution in Stiglitz's thinking, which he announced at the end of the program, from advocating reform of the IMF towards advocating its possible abolition. Here's an edited version of that soundbite heard around the world.
One of the aspects of globalization is that the countries of the world are today more integrated. They're more interdependent. And with more interdependence, there is greater need for collective action, a greater need as a result for international institutions to regulate in one way or another trade, finance, to provide humanitarian assistance. The problem is that some of the institutions we have are not democratic, they're not transparent, they reflect special interests within the more advanced industrial countries. They do not represent the concerns of the poor and the developing countries. Now, I used to say that since we are going to need these institutions, it is better to reform them than to start from scratch. I'm beginning to have second thoughts. I'm beginning to ask, has the credibility of the IMF been so eroded that maybe it's better to start from scratch? Is the institution so resistant to learning, to change, to becoming a more democratic institution, that maybe it is time to think about creating some new institutions that really reflect today's reality, today's greater sense of democracy? The world has changed enormously. And perhaps now, some 50 years afterwards, it's really time to re-ask the question, should we reform or should we build from start?
And that was Joseph Stiglitz speaking on this program last week. And Friday, the Dow Jones Newswire ran a story quoting big chunks of that text. And earlier this week, the Guardian of London and the Financial Times did as well. And now that I'm putting these shows up on the web, people from around the world have been tuning in. For a figure of Stiglitz's stature, he won the Nobel Prize in Economics last year and is regarded as one of the most distinguished economists of his generation. For him to come around to an abolitionist position is quite important, and you heard it here first. Speaking of the web radio archive, I've got 7 full shows up there now, as well as 4 individual interviews. To listen, visit www.leftbusinessobserver, that's all one word, leftbusinessobserver.com, and follow the link from the front page. And now to the most ridiculous item of the week, my appropriation of a feature of Bill O'Reilly's often hilarious show on the Fox News Channel. Just as last week's show was coming to a close, it was announced that Jack Grubman was leaving Solomon Smith Barney, but not in disgrace, with a $32 million severance package. No one personified the recent bubble era like Jack Grubman. Nominally a telecommunications analyst, he was the industry's great cheerleader and impresario during its late 90s bubble. He'd attend company board meetings and advise CEOs on strategy, acting as consigliere, in the words of an associate, and then come back to his desk under a buy now sign in big capital letters and write research reports recommending WorldCom, Quest, and Global Crossing. He didn't actually work the investment banking side, arranging finance or selling securities, but he strongly shaped the nominally independent banking operation. So he strongly influenced the funding and strategy of the companies he was supposed to be covering. He defended this by saying, what used to be a conflict is now a strategy, as he explained to Business Week, in a story published when the NASDAQ was already 20% off its peak. Being in the flow, as he put it, helped him to help bankers think about the industry. When the Business Week reporter wondered if being in the flow compromises objectivity as an analyst, Grubman would have none of it. Objective, he said. The other word for that is uninformed. Not, of course, that Grubman is without precedent. Andre Meyer and Felix Roten helped Harold Janine put together ITT, and J.P. Morgan reorganized Industrial America. Grubman's turf was telecommunications, an industry he said would double in size over the next several years. On his Solomon Smith Barney resume, he claimed a degree from MIT when he actually went to Boston University. In his autobiographical narrative, he claimed he was from the same South Philadelphia neighborhood as Frankie Avalon, and even more important to the former boxer as Rocky Balboa, but he wasn't from that neighborhood. Grubman explained his competitiveness and indefatigability by pointing to his modest origins. "I refuse to let anyone topple me. That's why I'm so myopically focused," he said. Evidently, his unconscious knew the definition of myopic, even if his conscience mind didn't. No doubt small investors bought stock based on TV or print exposure to Grubman, but he had a dedicated following among big money managers. They eagerly put billions into his deals, and buyers shunned firms that didn't have his blessing. An insatiable demand for bandwidth would guarantee the success of firms like WorldCom, Quest, Global Crossing, and Level 3, now all corporate wreckage. And though the often staid Business Week did raise ethical questions, like everyone else at the time, they took the bandwidth insatiability as pretty much axiomatic. Grubman had some company as Wall Street Renaissance man. At Credit Suisse First Boston, another son of South Philly, Frank Quattrone, played promoter, banker, and analyst. He operated from the Silicon Valley, far from Credit Suisse's New York headquarters, prompting comparisons to Michael Milken's independent Beverly Hills operation in the 1980s, which ran in isolation from Drexel Burnham's Manhattan home office. One of Quattrone's synergistic innovations, which might once have been considered a conflict of interest, was that he also ran a venture capital fund. His shop would invest in startups, then take them public in an initial public offering. But not many people ask the question, obvious both in theory and in hindsight, if this is such a great investment, why are you selling it to me? But it wasn't just a men's club. A third great synergist was Morgan Stanley's Mary Meeker, who cheered her stocks as tirelessly on the way up as she did as they were losing 90% of their value. She defended her multiple roles as banker, promoter, consultant, and analyst as not conflicting, but as a kind of stewardship, a responsibility. In 1995, she helped bring Netscape public, an event that many consider the originary moment of the Internet bubble. Soon after, she wrote a 300-page report touting the forthcoming cyberboom that became the bubble's sacred text. She, too, drove the bank's whole tech effort, visiting startups, cultivating ties to venture capitalists, arranging underwritings, and leaving the bankers just the details to handle. Annoyed at having lost the eBay IPO to Goldman Sachs, Meeker cultivated chair Meg Whitman by inviting her to dinner and bringing along a draft report, glowing, of course, on eBay. Whitman said that she felt honor-bound to stick with Goldman. Meeker published her report on the day eBay began trading, and half a year later, when the firm did another offering, they forced Goldman Sachs to split the deal with Morgan Stanley. Meeker was big on all the substitutes for profits that became so fashionable in the 1990s, eyeballs and hits and page views. She dismissed worries about preposterous stock valuations by saying that we'd entered a new valuation zone. But back to Grubman and his ridiculous $32 million parting check. Fortunately, today's papers carry the news that congressional investigators, are looking into the possibility that he allocated hard-to-get wads of newly issued stock to executives of companies he was trying to sign up as clients. That's illegal, though no doubt you could spin it as synergy. So there's some hope yet that he'll be breaking rocks someday. And back in just a minute to talk with Michael Sorkin and Sharon Zukin.
In Brooklyn at 1 a.m. watching the lights flash in Manhattan. I see your fire bridges, the Empire State Building, and you said something that I've never forgotten.
And that was P.J. Harvey from her album, All About This City. And during that song, she never explains what that something is that somebody said that she's never forgotten, which I guess is kind of appropriate. I feel very ambivalent about participating in the 9/11 anniversary extravaganza, not because memorials are unimportant, but because the issues are so complicated. Mainstream commemorations are trafficking in a really toxic mix of grandiosity and self-pity, a frequent cocktail in American cultural life, but this one's many times more potent than usual. It's as if no one ever else suffered a loss. The citizens of Beirut, Dresden, Hanoi, and Sarajevo would beg to differ. But bring that up and you run the risk of minimizing the horror of 3,000 deaths just blocks from where I'm sitting and the barbarity of the crime that killed them. Suicidal fundamentalists are not my idea of an admirable revolutionary force. But one way to avoid the toxic cocktail is to think about what should be built on the former site of the World Trade Center. It helps us think about the kind of city we've been and the city we could be. For all the brutalities of New York, I quite love this place, and 9/11 only deepened my attachment. So as a way of thinking about what happened and what could be and what's likely to be, I have asked the editors of a collection of essays to join us. The book is After the World Trade Center, Rethinking New York City, published a little while ago by Routledge. The editors are Michael Sorkin, architect, author, and director of the Graduate Urban Design Program at CCNY, and Sharon Zukin, professor of sociology at the CUNY Graduate Center, and also the Brooklundian professor of sociology at Brooklyn College. They join us in the studio. Brooklundian, is that a Dutch adjective for Brooklynite? Or?
I'm afraid it is.
How about that? Well, welcome to both of you.
Thank you.
Let's start with a history of the World Trade Center. As big a role as it took in our image of the city and our imaginations about it, it is a fairly recent construction, as these things go, or was a fairly recent construction. How did it get to be? What was there before?
Well, someone referred to the World Trade Center as the last of the big urban renewal projects of the 50s, and that's basically what it was. It was a gold mine for the Port Authority of New York and New Jersey, and for the Austin Tobin type leadership, very similar to Robert Moses' leadership.
Yeah, Austin Tobin's name comes up a lot. Who is he?
Well, he was the executive director. I'm not sure whether that was his exact title. I think it was executive director of the Port Authority. He was one of those public administrators who assume enormous power, like Robert Moses, because they can condemn land and convince legislatures to go along with their building program. Of course, in the case of the Port Authority, there's a century-long ambitious effort to move away from the railroads and the ports and the original transportation mission of the agency to go into real estate development big time. And the Port Authority, under that umbrella, banded together with some of the big property owners down here, like David Rockefeller from Chase Manhattan Bank, and others who wanted to complete the skyscraper transformation of Lower Manhattan. So they pushed out the public market that was still holding on, Washington Market, a wholesale fruit and vegetable market, completed its transfer up to Hunts Point in the Bronx, and pushed out the small stores like the radio and electronics distributors who were collectively known as Radio Row.
Now, but Washington Market wasn't just wholesale, right? I mean, there's some descriptions in the book of this great demographic mix that happened there.
In the early days of the towers, they were referred to as David and Nelson. And among other things, the World Trade Center represented Nelson pulling David's chestnuts out of the fire. One of the things that was happening downtown was that real estate values were sinking, and Midtown was competing for office space, and David's investments were going south. So it was convenient for him to have a brother governor in office in order to fill the World Trade Center towers, which couldn't be rented when they were built, with the state employees, thereby doing a good deed for the future of the family.
But there was something like 20-year period between this when this first entered David Rockefeller's mind and when they were actually built, wasn't it?
Well, real estate is a long story.
Well, they also migrated around Lower Manhattan. There were a variety of schemes, including Battery Park City and a similar scheme on the East River, which were gone through. The governor of New Jersey at that point objected to having the Port Authority construct something so distant from New Jersey, and part of the deal had to do with
The path train
and renovating the path and building these towers above this connection to New Jersey.
And what was the process? It took a long time, evidently, but what exactly was involved with the process of clearing out what was there and building these gigantic buildings?
Sharon refers to these extra legal authorities that we vest in the Port Authority and other such agencies. And among those powers is the right of condemnation. This simplifies things enormously, as you can imagine. They can condemn the land, they can issue bonds, and they can deviate from the New York City building codes, which is another story, but many think that this was contributory to the scale of the disaster, the fact that these buildings were unsprinkled and were not in conformity with the New York City building code.
I want to come back to that issue a little bit later, because we've heard some reports of shoddy construction contributing to the disaster, so I'd like to get back to that. But back to the creation part. So over the course of the 60s, I guess, this was planned. I mean, when did they actually start settle on a site and start clearing people out?
You're only asking the editor of the book. By the mid to late 60s, the site was chosen, the land was cleared, construction was begun, and I guess the first tower was occupied in the early 70s. So we're really talking about a mode of development that went on despite all the social movements and protests of the late 60s and early 70s. It just rolled on.
Yeah, now, was this controversial at the time? Were the people objected?
It was to a certain degree, but, you know, we've been sensitized by the building of the World Trade Center, by the historic preservation movement, which only really took off in this city in the early 60s, by the demolition of Penn Station and the effort to save Grand Central Terminal. We've been sensitized by all these battles over preservation, so that now we know that litigation would have been much fiercer than it was. Some of the small property owners and small business owners along Greenwich Street sued the Port Authority. I'm not sure whom they sued, but they sued to void the eviction orders, but they didn't win. These days, I think there would have been a much bigger protest.
And then, boy, they paid some of the people they kicked out, but they didn't pay them very much, did they?
I'm sure, yeah.
Well, I think there's one example in the book of somebody getting $16,000 for a four-story loft building or something.
Like, yes, well, you know, that's one of Eric Darton's long cherished issues. Eric, one of our authors in After the World Trade Center, is the author of Divided We Stand, a really excellent history of the World Trade Center. And Eric is more than anyone I know the one who still mourns the demise of Radio Row.
And it was also called a Syrian neighborhood, although that was a little loose term.
Yes, and in fact, Lower Manhattan has a long history of evictions, demolitions, transgressions, invasions. And from the time the Dutch displaced the Lenape tribe, there have been series of conquests and new people taking over the site. But in fact, around 1880, a number of immigrants from Syria and Lebanon, some Christian, some Muslim, began to settle along Greenwich Street, and they created a neighborhood that was known even in the 1940s as Little Syria. I think that they were forced to move by the construction of the entrance to the Brooklyn Battery Tunnel, and some of those people eventually moved to Atlantic Avenue in Brooklyn and started another Arab-American community. But there were restaurants and small stores and churches. There's still, I think, a church in that area near the Hudson River affiliated with the original Middle Eastern immigrants of the late 19th century.
One of our authors remembers thinking that Cedar Street had been named after the Cedars of Lebanon.
That was the voice of Michael Sorkin, who, along with Sharon Zuckert, whose voice you heard a little earlier, are the editors of After the World Trade Center, Rethinking New York City, just published, or recently published by Routledge. Now, you've got several essays in the book, and I should say it's a collection of, what, about maybe 20 essays or so?
Just under.
Several essays recount the history of this neighborhood, and I think most people have no idea of first of all, just how brutal it was in cases. And then there was a fire and a bomb. Could you tell us a bit of the history of this little lower tip of Manhattan?
This is the attack on the Morgan Bank?
In 1920, yes. Yes.
Go for it, Sharon.
Some unknown perpetrators were responsible for the detonation of a very powerful bomb at the Morgan Bank on this very block, I think.
26, I think. Oh, 26 Wall Street.
Oh, sorry, a couple of blocks away.
Broad Street.
And the city and U.S. governments at the time were so alarmed by the damage to property and the injuries to persons that they rounded up the known left-wing socialist activists at the time and tried to deport all of them, charge them, imprison them, deport them. It was never determined whose bomb it was and whether the detonation was accidental. So, although there were damages and quite a big scare, it was never clear. It's never been made clear who was responsible.
I walked by the site 20 minutes ago, and the scars are still very visible on the Morgan Bank from the bombing.
Well, yeah, I think Morgan chose not to repair it to show how invincible they were.
Yeah.
So now you can see these little pockmarks.
JP was up and running within 24 hours, I think.
I think, yes, it was only in 2001 that the financial institutions closed for several days.
But it's amazing. I mean, given the material and symbolic power of this neighborhood, that it hasn't really been a target more than, you know, two attacks 80 years apart. But, you know, it's kind of amazing.
Well, that was the blessedness, wasn't it, of American society. We all were lulled into precisely that feeling that we were exceptional, and that of course deepens the gap that Americans feel between themselves and the members of other societies who have been damaged by terrorist attacks and by wars.
Of course, there was the day that Abbey threw the dollar bills into the New York Stock Exchange.
Right. And then they quickly glassed in the wall so nobody could do that again.
Yeah.
Well, let's talk a bit about our insulation, the destruction, the tragedy. I mean, how do you handle this? I mean, and it, you know, there's danger, as I said in the introduction, of on the one hand, acting as if nobody else has ever suffered and our innocence has been shattered, our deserved and sacred innocence has been shattered. On the other hand, you don't want to minimize the crime or the suffering of the people who died. I mean, how do you balance these things? How do you do it in doing the book and thinking about the issues involved?
Well, one of the things we tried to do in the book was to think prospectively about the future of New York City, using this as an occasion to think through issues that were raised about our urban future in general. But I don't think we should be part of the game of minimizing the scope of the tragedy. I mean, 3,000 people were murdered in an hour in New York City, and
that's grave. Yeah.
That's grave.
Indeed, literally a grave site. But as actually one of your contributors pointed out, people were people and building materials were vaporized, so that we literally were breathing our buildings and our neighbors.
Yes.
Which is, I shuddered actually when I read that phrase. It was kind of stunning.
Well, as an architect, I'm very invested in thinking about the physical future of the site, and certainly one cannot think about the future of the site without thinking about the aura, as it were, of the tragedy. And one of the interesting things that's been happening in the last 6 months is an effort to try to physicalize, in effect, the aura of the tragedy. We know, for example, that Governor Pataki came out a few months ago for the sacralization of the footprints. And I think there is a consensus emerging, if I can presume that, that the footprints of the towers are particularly sacred space on the site. I think this was part of what came up in the whole discussion of the several schemes the Lower Manhattan Development Corporation proposed. The ones that seemed to be supportable by the public were the ones that let the footprints stand clear in some way or another. But one thing that hasn't been decided is what, in effect, the throw weight, if you will, of those footprints is. Can you build right next to them? Can you build directly underneath them, as is being proposed? Do they extend infinitely into the heavens? I think that this is something that one has to confront. And it's not simply a matter of the physical dimension of the aura, but also the influence of the aura in terms of demanding certain uses on the site. I mean, in the same way that a discotheque is not appropriate at Baba Yar or a casino on Omaha Beach, the question hasn't been answered about whether you can make McDonald's within 50 feet of the footprints, or whether it takes 100 feet or 150 feet. I mean, it is only 14 acres, finally, so these dimensional and use issues, I think, are very important. And to me, a good way of having this conversation about the meaning of the event, because it obliges a translation from kind of psychical terms into spatial and physical ones.
One more bit about the past before we get back to the future. The buildings were not very popular with architects or critics, but one of the contributors muses on the fact that the public liked them very much. Why didn't architects like it, and why do you think it had this kind of popular appeal?
Ugly, monotony, too tall. I guess that's about it. Alien unlife forms in what should be a very vibrant area of the city.
I don't think their failure was as towers. I wouldn't say indifferent to them, but I didn't hate the towers. I did hate the space at the base of the towers, and the way it was impossible to walk across the site, the way it absolutely killed through circulation downtown, the hostility to pedestrian activity, that miserable shopping mall underground, and so on and so forth. But the height of the towers, and I was always myself amazed that there were two identical 110-story buildings there, as if architecture had suddenly entered the realm of consumer goods. I mean, they were styled like toasters. They were stainless steel. They looked like appliances, and there were two of them, for God's sake. I mean, they were amazing.
You know something interesting, though? Someone who wrote about the towers after September 11th pointed out that Minoru Yamasaki, the architect who designed them, intended the filigree effect of the facade to evoke Middle Eastern decoration. And I was quite stunned to see that he had worked out this motif over a number of years in the 1960s when I visited the campus of Wayne State University in Detroit, not far from where Yamasaki's office was during his lifetime. I saw a miniature version of our World Trade Center on the campus. He had actually, Yamasaki himself had actually designed two buildings on the campus there, one of which looked remarkably like the World Trade Center, but much smaller. And apparently his firm did some building in Saudi Arabia.
Well, they were the architects to the House of Saud, mm-hmm, basically, and, mm-hmm. and if I'm not mistaken, some of the construction was yes. done by the
Bin Laden
father
family.
Of Bin Laden.
Yeah.
Wow! If you did that in a novel, nobody would believe you.
Yeah, but of course, yes. If you want to sort of do the Yamasaki thing, I mean, he was also the author of the celebrated Pruitt-Igoe housing project in St. Louis, the demolition of which is largely considered to be the opening gun on the period of postmodernity in architecture.
Yes, he's truly a cursed architect, isn't he?
But nonetheless, they became popular and iconic. Why is that? Just because they're so enormous?
Yeah, I think that's a really good reason. Yes, they were so outsized. And during the 1990s, with stock market fever taking the nation, they became a familiar and I wouldn't say beloved, but appreciated and celebrated landmark.
Certainly, one way of reading the New York City skyline is as a bar graph of the success of property. And these buildings represented the greatest multiplication of property in the history of consciousness. So in terms of this analysis of the skyline as representing value directly, what could have been more valuable? And the view from the top was magnificent.
Right.
All right, let's take a little break and come back and talk about the future.
A rooftop Manhattan, one in the morning. That I've never forgotten. You said something. You said something. You said something that was really important.
A little more of that P.J. Harvey song. And we're back. I remember walking out of BMCC once, I think it was a Socialist Scholars Conference, and looking up at the buildings that then climaxed in the World Trade Center and just had this moment of thinking of the financial sublime. These buildings were just so big and overpowering, but it wasn't just their physicality, but it was what was behind them, who was inside them, what it all represented.
There certainly was a classic aura of sublimity about those buildings. I mean, imagine a building that could simply disappear into the weather on a given day. This was something extraordinary to see.
All right, now, obviously something's going to replace them, and, in New York City, just about everything turns on a real estate question. What's the process now? Who's in charge of this, and how's it going to be decided?
Good question.
Yeah, excellent question. There is a venal and incompetent. Let me back up. The nominal authorities are the Lower Manhattan Development Corporation, which is a subsidiary of the Empire State Development Corporation, which is a Port Authority-like organization that exists to foster economic development in New York State. As such, again, they are able to operate outside of normal rules, outside of the purview of the City Planning Commission, the Building Department.
And if I remember right, the director of the EDC is actually appointed by the Chamber of Commerce, the New York City Partnership, right? So it's not even it's a public authority that's privately controlled.
The key players I dare say at the moment are Daniel Doktoroff, who is the deputy mayor for economic development. You know, the board of the LMDC, which is basically a bunch of white male plutocrats, with apologies to Marshall Berman, who thinks this is racist talk.
With a few other appointees, whom Mayor Bloomberg named.
Is that the one that Whitehead is the
head? Yeah, Whitehead is the head.
Former Goldman Sachs co-chair.
Right, exactly. Right, yes. And, you know, Verizon and the real estate industry is well represented. Mayor Bloomberg, to his credit, appointed some women and people of color to the commission, but I think they're in the far minority. Obviously, the governor is a key player, and he seems to be temporizing a bit in anticipation of the election. And it'll be very interesting to see what he says afterwards. As I mentioned earlier, the governor is one person who has come out four square for the sacrality of the footprints. Which other public officials have not. So at least he's got a marker down for what he expects to happen on the site physically.
I just realized I forgot to do the radio housekeeping. This is WBAI 99.5 FM in New York. My name is Doug Henwood. The program is Behind the News. And you just heard Michael Sorkin, who, along with Sharon Zukin, is the editor of the After the World Trade Center, Rethinking New York City, recently published by Routledge. Now, there was a round of proposals, right, and they were all just kind of thrown out recently?
I don't know. I went to the – anybody here go to that public – the so-called public meeting at the Javits Center? Yeah. This was the Lower Manhattan Development Corporation went through a process of hiring an architectural firm to make proposals for the site. This was a process that was, to put it mildly, corrupt. Involving, as it did, a set of criteria which were designed to encourage a very small number of very large corporate architectural firms to apply for the gig.
And this framework was built by Whitehead and Company?
Yep. One of them was duly appointed, and they were given a few months to come up with a set of alternative schemes, which they did, but at the same time, two of the real estate developers involved in the site had their own architects, and the LMDC hired another architectural firm, a firm that was good buddies with its design director to propose schemes. So the six that were presented were, in fact, an amalgam of the projects made by Beyer, Blinder & Bell, the officially sanctioned firm, the in-house design firm.
They're not known for inspiration
in
the trade, right? They're not known for producing inspired work in the trade, are they?
They are not. Nor have they ever. What they are known for is some careful preservationism. These are the architects who did the restoration of Grand Central Station. But a spark of genius is not present in there.
But the structural factor, however, was set by those infamous contracts and leases that had been signed by the Port Authority. So that the right of the real estate developer Larry Silverstein as the major leaseholder of the office buildings, and the arrangement that I guess Silverstein had made with Westfield, the shopping center developers from Australia, those were the key factors that determined the amount of land that was dedicated to different uses plans.
I mean, if one is inclined to think conspiratorially, and who ain't, the charitable conspiratorial explanation of what happened is that these three gray-haired guys, Beyer, Blinder, and Bell, were chosen to design something with this completely unsupportable program, 12 million square feet of office space and a shopping mall on the site, in order to take the fire of the public that I think many anticipated would immediately erupt on presentation of such corrupt schemes, which they duly did. Now there's a lot of backing and filling by the LMDC. There's an RFQ out for smaller, more creative design firms who are to be awarded $40,000 each to work for 1 month to come up with other suggestions.
One month—that's not a lot of time.
I think this is called cover your ass. But again, the fundamental idea of what is appropriate on the site has not been decided.
And does this neighborhood really need 12 million square feet of office space?
Well, this city doesn't really need 12 million
square feet. We've got a lot of empty spaces.
Every fifth floor downtown is now vacant, according to statistics. So there is more vacant space downtown at the moment than was lost in the Trade Center.
And the problem with real estate people is that they never learn from their experience, and they go through these boom and bust cycles. They build, and they overbuild, and then they stop building, and then they build again, and then they overbuild again, and so on. And it just is so incredible that this process could now be sponsored and, yeah, and mandated by the state.
We're also assuming that what is concealed here is the active negotiation of Larry Silverstein to renegotiate or
yeah, what rights does he have
his
in
lease?
Now?
He's got a 99-year lease
on the land.
On the land.
But the land owned by the Port Authority?
Yeah. Of course, one of the truly bizarre episodes in this is his attempt to persuade his insurer that two events, I think that's the term of art, two events had taken place on the site rather than one.
One for David and one for Nelson.
One for David and one for Nelson, which would presumably allow him to double his return from the insurance. This argument was found wanting, but this is the level of venality that's determining the future of the site.
Yes, but in fact, Michael's right to bring in Swiss Re, which is another actor in this whole thing, merely because they control the compensation payments to Larry Silverstein.
And do we know where they stand on what? They just want their money,
I
guess.
I'm not sure.
Or they want to minimize the payout.
One event, yeah. No. Obviously, they want to minimize their payout. Yeah.
Well, they spoke, the head of Swiss Re spoke out favorably for the land swap that was proposed a few weeks ago, the land swap that would give the city government control of the 16 acres of the World Trade Center site in exchange for the land under Kennedy and LaGuardia airports.
But McGreevy is now.
Yes, Governor McGreevy of New Jersey says this isn't good. Yes, this isn't good. New Jersey doesn't get paid this
way. On the other hand, the idea of a swap as a conceptual operation is logical. There are plenty of fallow sites around New York City that could use a little bit of development. So if one looked a little more broadly, there are plenty of places that some ingenious financial arrangements might bring under Silverstein's influence where he could build his office space as profitably as on the World Trade Center site.
But from everything one knows about New York City, it seems very hard to believe that that much space could go minimally developed. I mean, something's going to happen there, right?
Sure.
It's not going to be a pure memorial, in other words. Somebody's got to make some money.
That's what everyone is fighting over. But in fact, there is an interesting, I hate to call it left wing, but an interesting action going on off the left flank. Paul Byard, the historic preservationist and architect, had a little piece on the op-ed page of the Times proposing that some of this land might well be dedicated to creating a headquarters or a research center for a humanitarian, progressive kind of world organization that would, for example, study globalization in its bad effects on the poor of the world. And this
I noticed he also weirdly included the World Bank and the IMF in that.
Yes, yes.
I
haven't subjected that text to close scrutiny, but this is, in part, is precisely the angle that has been so lacking from public discussions and reflections of the event. That is, there has been very little public reflection on American foreign policy and any response other than a military response.
Yeah, well, deemed unpatriotic. And
yes, absolutely.
I mean, the idea of putting a piece of the UN there has certainly been bruited, and there's lots of discussion about some kind of righteous set of operations taking place on the site.
But on the other hand, it's got to be devoted to money making, or the terrorists would have won.
Well, money-making and also patriotism. I mean, there's been a very strong swath of proposals all along to link the World Trade Center site conceptually and visually with the Statue of Liberty and Ellis Island, the Holocaust Memorial.
One of the interesting things that has happened is exactly that the idea that the whole site be dedicated to memorialization of the event. That idea has been taken off the table. Very quietly, you know, the strongest advocates for this initially were some of the organized survivor groups, but they don't seem to be calling for this any longer. I must say I'm now of two minds. Initially, I thought that was the right thing to do on a gravesite, was to memorialize it and keep it clean of commerce. I'm changing my view a bit. You know, I think some of these righteous operations on the site are possible.
Well, you have a plan in the book, in your chapter in there, where you propose what might be done, right?
Yeah.
Have you changed your mind from that?
Yeah, I have, actually. Uh-huh. I mean, that was a plan about keeping the site clear. And one of the things that I think we demonstrated in that little piece of work was, a disaggregated approach in which one would take 2 million square feet worth and put it in the Bronx Hub or, you know, next to Yankee Stadium or in Jamaica, that one could easily make up the lost space and at the same time regenerate some struggling neighborhoods, if that were policy. That was move number one that we proposed. And the second move was the one I mentioned earlier, which was just to cast a slightly wider eye around Lower Manhattan. You know, there are a lot of soft and undeveloped sites downtown which could easily provide 10 or 12 million square feet of office space.
You know, there's a lot of discussion now about how to use some of the World Trade Center space to support future lines of economic development, but nobody knows what they're going to be. I mean, biotechnology, I think, is just ridiculous to contemplate
plopping down in
Lower Manhattan. There's a certain amount of buzz around the remnants of the new economy, whatever those are, and creative occupations. But, you know, startup firms, especially in creative fields, need low space, they need old space, and they need cheap rents. So I can't see building even mid-size office towers for some kind of creative renaissance in Lower Manhattan.
Well, let's ask that socioeconomic question. How much need is there for a neighborhood like this one? Do we need to have financiers crowded in a small space like this? Are the virtues of their face-to-face meeting greater than the cost advantages of their dispersing and into cheaper neighborhoods and doing it all by electronics?
Well, the segmentation of the market for space in the traditional downtown industries has already taken place, and to a degree, you know, the executives have migrated to Midtown, the traders remain downtown, and the back office folks are in Metro Tech or New Jersey
or Bangalore, even.
Or Bangalore, yes. Yeah, exactly, yes. Working in the middle of the night. But you know, the face to face is very important, and this is a brilliant neighborhood. In terms of engendering those kinds of contacts, which I think are indispensable not just to doing business but to culture and democracy.
Well, as somebody points out, maybe it was you, that one of the interesting things about this neighborhood, which make it so much more interesting than Midtown, is the sort of imposition of skyscrapers on this very old, twisted Dutch street plan.
On a medieval street grid, yeah. Yeah, it's totally fabulous and weird.
Yeah,
but you know what the great potential of Lower Manhattan is, and this is alluded to in some of the public statements of Madeline Wills, the chairwoman of Community Board 1, that is a potential to go truly from east to west in Lower Manhattan and to link Chinatown, which is a really dynamically growing community in Manhattan as well.
But it had taken quite a blow after 9/11, hadn't it?
Yes, but still, that has huge potential to continue growing now, to link Chinatown with the financiers and other middle class types who live on the Lower West Side now. Community Board 1 has talked about how they want access to the east side. They want walking streets. They want to be able to see visually over to the East River from the Hudson River. But the kinds of stores, the kinds of services, and some of the kinds of excitement that the higher income residents of Lower Manhattan want could be linked successfully with Chinatown, and so far that has been absent from any discussion of the planning. And now we're talking not just about what's going to go on the World Trade Center site, and not what the architectural forms and designs are going to be, but what kind of neighborhood, as you asked, what kind of neighborhood, Doug, is going to be created in Lower Manhattan? And what I'd like to see is a mixed-use, mixed-income, mixed-ethnic area that now has a chance to be.
Finance and real estate people don't really like neighborhoods like Chinatown. They're smelly and full of people that they don't find appealing to their eye. And
well, indeed, some of those vegetable stands do get pretty smelly in the dog days of August.
I mean, if you read some of the old zoning or some of the material leading up to the zoning, it was all like aesthetic objections of rich people to all these working class and poor people.
There's another set of links that's being much discussed nowadays. You know, it's for many years, the book on Lower Manhattan is that it is disadvantaged in terms of transportation. Good subway links and a PATH train going to New Jersey, but no rail link to the north and no rail link to Long Island. And I think that we are passing through a very narrow window at the moment in which the possibility of major public investment in this kind of heavy infrastructure has to be made relatively soon, or the opportunity will slip away.
What do you think of Jerry Nadler's pet plan to rebuild the port and have a rail link to the mainland and all that?
Well, his idea is this Cross Harbor Tunnel, which goes from New Jersey to Brooklyn. It doesn't go under this site, but the idea of bringing Metro North or Amtrak down, the idea of connection with the Long Island Railroad in particular, these seem like very sensible ideas. And certainly, I don't think that there's anything in philosophical conflict with progressive opinion about the World Trade Center might be with the idea of this being a site where lots of people are enabled to gather and come together with the efficiency and comfort. I think this would be a great legacy to downtown.
That's Michael Sorkin, who, along with Sharon Zukin, are the editors of After the World Trade Center, Rethinking New York City, recently published by Routledge. Sharon Zukin, you were kind of alluding to this before, more mixed-use city. I mean, this neighborhood is mostly devoted to commerce of a very high end, at the very high end.
But, since 1995, under the aegis to some degree of the Downtown Alliance, a business group, a business improvement district of all things, residents has been encouraged. Now,
that's mainly because they can't rent the office.
Yes,
space, right?
I was just going to say partly that, partly to be a little sister to Battery Park City and the residents who have been marooned along the Hudson River on the other side of West Street. But this is a good idea. I think having more residents in that area is a terrific idea. That leads to the kind of all day, all night neighborhood that people seem to like these days. Mm-hmm. And I think more residents create the potential base of support for good public space that most of us would like to see in Lower Manhattan.
Yeah. And there is a way in which large-scale infrastructural improvements can benefit the finer-grained neighborhoods like Chinatown, for example. One of the things under discussion, about which there seems to be some consensus, is that West Street should be buried, finally, so that Battery Park City can be attached to the mainland. If one started that burial at Canal Street and continued it all the way around to the Manhattan Bridge, the problem of Canal Street traffic, which is not hospitable to the ambitions of Chinatown, could be solved. The crosstown traffic, the trucks going from the Holland Tunnel to the Manhattan Bridge, could be routed around the island underground and straight onto the BQE, which would be a great boon for Chinatown and its expansion and development.
Yes.
Now, is there any way to pry open the existing process for these sorts of ideas, or is it pretty much going to be decided by the usual gang?
You know, we don't know.
It's a rhetorical question.
One of the great delights of the past few months has been perhaps grudging and gradual opening of the door to other possibilities other than the ones that were originally laid on the table. And this, you know, this is a funny kind of democratization. There is no planning process.
Yeah.
So there's no democratic planning process in place in New York City. Yet there have been so many civic organizations that have got involved and people writing about this and talking about this that I think there's been a much wider public discussion about planning than ever before in the city.
This has been fantastic. Unfortunately, the whole thing gets assimilated into the typical planning rhythm, which is that the authorities propose and the public objects. This has now happened a couple of times at the two so-called public meetings. The first one, people from Chinatown were in the Lower East Side were very well organized and dominated the meet. And John Whitehead was just shocked. I mean, had no idea the havoc that was caused in people's lives in those places or the anger that they felt of being cut out. And there was some backing up at that point. The huge meeting at the Javits Center, which was structured like a meeting of the Politburo in Pyongyang, you know, in 1959, you know, we have the party has prepared these six identical plans for you, comrades. You will now vote. Somehow the people found a way of saying, screw all of this. You know, we don't like any of them. And I think the people were taken a little bit aback by the vocalism of the public reaction.
By the same token, a lot of people would like to rebuild the two towers the way they were. A lot of people would like to do things that other people don't want to do. Of course, democracy is always messy.
Well, on that democratic note, we'll have to end. Thank you both for joining us, speaking with Michael Sorkin and Sharon Zukin, who are the editors of After the World Trade Center, Rethinking New York City, a collection of almost 20 essays recently published by Routledge. That's it for me, Doug Henwood. Stay tuned for the news, and on until the evening. Until next week, goodbye.
The sun comes swaggering across the harbor and kisses the lady waiting in the narrows. And she already plenty shaky stands there, bless you, clutching the torch of liberty. Uptown Luigi, who don't speak English so good, is having an accident, backing his dump truck into the fence.